As a literary agent, you know there's only one thing I like talking about more than books, and that's money. More importantly, cash that stays in your pocket. I'm on the lookout for our listeners at all times. I'm combing deal memos and book publishing contracts for hidden ways that writers are on the hook, and that's why we are thrilled to partner with Chime, who's changing the way people bank. They offer the most rewarding fee-free banking built just for you. That's right, built for you, not the 1%. Chime members can benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Direct deposit unlocks the most rewarding way to bank at Chime. Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. That's real humans 24/7. You're not just switching banks, you're upgrading to America's number one choice for banking with a Chime checking account. They're not like traditional old banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. And if you're like me and travel a bunch and love premium travel perks like airport lounge access, you've got it. And the 24/7 travel concierge included with your Chime card. My younger self would have loved a fast-tracked airport lounge access. You get 5% cash back on Chime card in a category of your choice, like gas or groceries for your next writer's retreat. You get savings that grow faster with 3.75 APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can even get up to $500 of your pay when you say, "With my pay." They also have SpotMe, which lets you overdraft up to $200 fee-free. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/tsnotya. That's chime.com/tsnotya. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Hi, everybody. You have both Cece and Carly today. We were completely just like ships crossing. What's the saying? Ships passing in the wind? We were ships passing in the wind.
In the night, I think.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Well,
ships
listen,
passing
we're
in
ships
the night,
passing
I think.
In the night.
I don't know. We're ships. We're ships doing something. Shit ships.
We are finally back in our port. We're back in our port, back at home, and we are, you know, not in hotel rooms. We're just shooting the shit at home, and I'm happy to see Cece. We had some gossipy stuff before recording that we had to go through, which, you know, lots of stuff we'll be able to talk about later. But yeah, we're back to shoot some shit. So one thing I wanted to let you guys know, so if you're listening to this on the day it comes out, which is Monday, on Wednesday, we're going to do another one of our Substack lives for the podcast paid subscriber. So if you are a paid podcast Substack subscriber, on Wednesday at noon, Wednesday, July 22nd at noon, we're going to do one of our live events. And we had so much fun doing it last time that I'm very excited that we get to do this again. So please come join us. I'll set a reminder on Substack. So you guys who are already registered, you're able to see that email come through. But yeah, we'll see you next week live.
It'll be so much fun. And remember, what happens in the Substack Live stays in the Substack Live. So if you are joining us, you must keep all things confidential because it's a little bit of a more fun episode, I will say.
Yeah, we talk about books we don't finish. We talk about books we didn't like. So, like, you know, you're getting us, let's say, unfiltered, honest, obviously professional as
unedited.
Always. Unedited.
We can't edit because we're live.
But we have a lot of fun and we had such a great turnout and you guys had great questions because in the live, we can see you guys commenting literally like when we're saying things, which so that reflects the direction of the conversation, which is awesome. So yeah. So Wednesday, the 22nd at noon, if you're not a paid subscriber to the podcast, now's the time, obviously. We're going to make sure we're doing these quarterly because we enjoyed them so much. And yeah, you actually can go back and watch them, but Cece doesn't like it when I say that because it is a bit off the cuff.
Stop telling people that. Like every time I'm like, shh, you don't have to tell people they can go back and watch. Oh God, they're going to do that. Okay.
I know. Well, okay. We're not going to recount all of our travels because we do that all the time, but I'm back from vacation. Cece's back from a conference. But the thing that everybody was talking about when I got back was this Atlantic article. And Cece, I know, read it right before we recorded. The title of the article, you know, not the most uplifting title. You guys have seen this one going around. This one is called "The End of Reading is Here" by Rose Horowitz. And yeah, it's, as I said, not the most uplifting. And Now, I saw it going around on Threads. We pulled some different kind of quotes to talk about. Cece, do you want to talk about what your initial thoughts on this article?
The last rose who depressed me this much was the rose from the Titanic movie when she dropped the necklace into the ocean. This was a wonderfully written article, very important. Please, Rose, if you were listening, I'm not trying to disparage your article, but depressing, which I'm pretty sure you understand why. Yeah, I think that this isn't really an article about the death of reading. It's an article about the death of thinking, because it makes the case, and every reader knows this, every writer knows this, that reading is thinking. Because you're consuming writing, and writing is the ultimate form of thinking. And it was a challenge. Challenge to read. There's so many things that we could highlight. I don't know where you want to begin.
Yeah, I kind of started at the top. I pulled a few different things that stood out to me. One of them was, and I've ranted about this before, but gambling has become a more common leisure activity than reading a book. Last year, 57% of Americans placed a bet, where only 38% read a novel or a short story. That is, that's kind of tragic. Maybe somebody needs to set a book in a casino or in Vegas and merge these two worlds together.
And send it to Carly and me, because we both want this. You know, you'll win. Whoever you go with, you'll win. This one wasn't surprising to me, though. Like, it was definitely depressing, but not surprising at all, just given how, you know, the increase of gambling and the dopamine hit that your brain gets when you gamble and all that. But
One of the other things that stood out to me was, as a parent, this quote: there's a study of over 200,000 American adults. Only 2% read to a child on any given day. I'm like, oh, that one stabbed me right in the heart. That was a tough one.
That one's so hard. That one's definitely really hard. What I found interesting was knowing that the study apparently looked at 236,000 responses. The proportion of Americans who read for pleasure on any given day fell from 28% in 2004. So 2004 was a long time ago at this point, to 16% in 2023. I actually had thought, oh, that's actually not as bad as I might have imagined. Then I read the sentence that clarified that the study was looking at people who read not just books, but a magazine or a newspaper, and they were including in reading of books, as they should, audiobooks and ebooks. And so then I was, you know, at first I was like, oh, not as bad as I had expected. And then I'm like, oh yeah, pretty bad. Because a magazine, come on, people, magazines are so great.
Yeah, I know. And I think, I mean, a lot of the article just leads to this idea where, you know, we are basically losing our higher order abilities of comprehension, which, like, as a whole is pretty depressing. One of the things I would say, you know, if we want to maybe target some of the weaknesses of the article, I felt like it was really talking down YA romance and women's fiction. It's a tale as old as time, basically, that we're kind of talking down things that women are more interested in. But, you know, that was, you know, I think a weaker spot in the article. It also kind of suggested that reading was like a blip in human history. But the article argued, like, as a society, we were illiterate until the 1400s. Basically, that we might be again in the future, that like the literate era will be a brief interlude between the oral and the digital ages. I'm like, do we really think that like our literacy levels are going to slide that much? I mean, obviously, we don't have a crystal ball, but that's a tough pill to swallow.
I don't think it will. I think that when it comes to reading, the reason why it's such a special activity comes down to the fact that it allows your imagination to be both entertained and enlightened. And for me, that is a primal human instinct. Our imagination, our inventiveness, our complexity, like that is all very human. And so I think books might adapt, and I don't know how, because that I definitely cannot predict, but I just don't think that we'll stop consuming them. The consumption might look a little bit different, but yeah, I just don't believe that. I just don't believe that at all.
And the article also was talking about the concept of writing, right? Because we don't have books without writing. One of the quotes was, "Writing is hard. Orwell likened the experience to a long bout of some painful illness. AI promises a simple remedy. The trouble is that writing is not merely the act of transcribing fully formed thoughts. If it were, it wouldn't be hard. Writing is the way people figure out what they think and how to convey those thoughts to someone who doesn't already share them." And if we're losing the cognitive ability to want to write and want to read, then we're going to kind of lose all that interconnected tissue, which, again, another depressing thought.
Yeah, yeah. There was one part of the article that really gave me pause. It was talking about writing with AI, and then it said that the product of AI is often better than what someone could compose on their own. And I'm like, no,
totally disagree with that.
Yeah, only if maybe your word vomit, sure. Maybe AI is at a point where it's better than someone's word vomit. But to the article's earlier point, the reason why writing is hard is because you test out an argument and then you realize it's not holding up on paper. So you write it again and again and again, rethinking it and revisiting it in your mind. And so, yes, maybe AI is at the point where it's better than word vomit, but it's definitely not better than someone's intentional, mindful, and intelligent work. Yeah. And so for me, that was an important distinction.
I feel like that line was a misstep too, because obviously people that read The Atlantic are a certain type of person. I'm sure we can all assume the type of person who, you know, educated, subscribes to the, if they subscribe to the magazine because it was behind a paywall, that you're of a certain socioeconomic background. And also all of you guys listening to this, you know, you're not the ones also whose writing could be improved by AI, because your writing is better than that. So we're not looking for mediocrity here. You guys, we know our listeners, we know how smart you are, and we know you guys are super talented. There was one thing that was trying to be hopeful in the article, which is the quote, "By some measures, at least, books continue to thrive. Last year, print book sales were higher than they were a decade ago. Barnes & Noble opened 60 new stores. Almost 400 independent bookstores sprang up in 2025. Substack has seen an explosion of subscriptions for long-form writing. Celebrities such as Dua Lipa and Reese Witherspoon have used their fame and influence to launch wildly successful book clubs. Audiobooks have become a billion-dollar industry." So that is, I think, what we're going to try and focus on here. I mean, nothing that you haven't heard on this show before, but let's focus on the positive, I guess.
Absolutely. Let's focus on the positive.
Yes. All right. And now we are going to hear from our sponsors. If you're one of those people who find summer wardrobes tricky, the key is finding items you can wear on repeat, comfortable colors on trend and right for every occasion. That's why I love Quince. They make elevated essentials using premium materials like European linen, organic cotton, and washable silk without the traditional retail markup. Quince has 100% European linen. Pants, dresses, and tops are the pieces you'll reach for all summer long. They're lightweight, effortless to style, and start at just $32. I got the European linen black drawstring shorts, and I adore them. They're polished, while being casual, and go with everything. Their denim is soft and comfortable. Their organic cotton sweaters are perfect for layering when evenings cool down. Quince's beautiful 14-karat gold jewelry adds a subtle finishing touch. Simple hoops or delicate chains make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. I have the gold U hoops and wear them literally every day. If you watch our clips, you will see me in them. Everything at Quince is priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. Make your summer wardrobe feel easier. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
Hi everyone, it's time to register for the next beta reader matchup, with the matchup emails going out on the 8th of September. As per usual, you'll be submitting 3,000 words from your work in progress, and I'll be matching you up with writers in similar time zones and or genres. Many of the beta reader groups turn into writing groups with a lot of longevity, which is always marvelous to see. To sign up, go to my website, biancamurray.ca, and go to the Beta Reader Matchup page. I look forward to matching you.
Welcome back, everybody. We are going to talk about an Instagram post that came up on our feed that was very interesting. I mean, nothing that Cece and I don't know, but something that we thought that you guys might be curious about. The Instagram account is Diasporaco, D-I-A-S-P-O-R-A-C-O, and they are doing a cookbook. And so if you guys don't know, cookbooks are very expensive to produce. And so this lovely author kind of went through like her advance, what she spent on everything, you know, how much they paid the agent. Obviously, you guys know all of this, you know, it's broken up into four parts. And one of the things that, again, you guys might not know is that the author, depends on the publisher, but oftentimes the author is the one that has to kind of upfront all of the costs for the recipe creation. So they're going to the grocery store, doing all of that. They have to pay for a recipe tester. They have to pay for the photographer and the food stylist. And so, you know, you might see some of these like larger cookbook deals. And so this author says we got 250K, which sounds like a lot of money, but then you divide that into four parts, you pay the agent, and then think about everything that has to be front loaded in terms of cost. This person was out of pocket very early on in the process. So it's a really great video. I encourage you guys to watch it. I believe it came out on July 14th. So you might have to scroll back through her feed, but she has a wonderful feed. So give her a follow, Diaspora Co., and learn a little bit about the economics of cookbook publishing, because it might surprise you.
It surprises so many authors. I actually remember one of the first writers I ever spoke to when I became an agent. You know, she was telling me about, she was like, oh, I got this deal, but it was quite low. And she mentioned the advance. And I told her, like, listen, the thing about advances is they can be anything from zero to millions of dollars. I mean, saying that it's low or high, I mean, definitely compared to what you want, but she was asking me, is this low or high? And I'm like, I can't tell you that. I haven't read your book, you know? And she was like, yeah, but I have this friend who made, and then she mentioned this like high number.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the conversation, I figured out that her friend was writing a cookbook. And I was like, well, no, because your friend is going to pay for a ton of production costs, the pictures, the, you know, and she's like, oh no, I'm sure the publisher is going to pick that tab. And I'm like, no, not how it works. I wish it were. I understand people thinking that the publisher would pay for that by default, I mean. And once upon a time they did, but.
But also a lot of times these days, like, it also affects control, right? So if the publisher is going to pay for it, then they are going to want to have control over everything to do with visuals. If you, the author, do the hiring, there's a lot of like consultation and approvals and all very specific language in the contract about, again, consultation and approval over all of the visuals. But you have control over who you hire. It has to be approved by the publisher. But there's a lot more control, which I think, you know, especially if you work in such a digital space, a lot of these are digital creators who are coming up with these cookbook ideas. I can see how, even though you have to front those costs, in the grand scheme of things, because a lot of these people, this is their business. So they are treating it like a business. This is just an extension of their brand. They're investing it as a piece of their business. It can make sense. We never know with books how many copies we're going to sell, which is always the big question mark when you're front loading a lot of costs.
I mean, I'll be honest and say it still doesn't make sense to me just because of the royalty rate. You know, if they made the majority of the royalty, sure, it still doesn't. I still find it wildly unfair, but I understand the advantages of control for sure. Because, you know, you want it to look a certain way. Visuals are so important in a cookbook. Do you use cookbooks at all?
Yes and no. Ever since I've had my second kid, I do next to none of the cooking. My husband has taken over all of the cooking.
Gotcha.
I do cook, the very small sliver, yes, I do.
Gotcha.
I do love cookbooks. I have a few recipes I go to online, but I work on cookbooks. I sell cookbooks. I love the idea of them. And so in the limited amount of cooking I do these days, yes, I do.
Yeah.
How about you?
They're also the best gift, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're such a great gift. It's such a wonderful thing. So I, too, quite recently, don't do most of the cooking at my home. I used to for so many years because I'm so controlling and I love cooking. But one day my husband was like, I'm going to learn and I'm going to do it your way. I promise I'll do it exactly as you want me to do it. Okay. And I'm like, no, you're not going, like, it's just not going to work. And he was like, just trust me with this. So he took over and now he does the cooking. So, I mean, I stopped, but I have so many cookbooks. Love cookbooks. They're great. And like I said, they're also like my go-to gift. Like, it's the best.
Mm-hmm. They are, I mean, we're going on a huge cookbook tangent here, but they are also one of the books that are going up in price quite a bit. I don't know if anybody has seen a cookbook. Like, if you're going to pay full retail price for a physical cookbook these days, they can be $40, $45.
Yeah.
They are definitely
going up in price.
It's a good gift. It's a good
gift. Right? Like,
it's
a good hostess gift. Yeah.
Yeah. They're expensive to produce, you know, with all the full color. Anyway, they are beautiful and expensive, but that's why you're also seeing more cookbooks done in like French flaps and paperbacks, because a hardcover cookbook these days is a very expensive but beautiful gift. So if you're going to learn anything from this episode today, please buy more gifts for friends, buy more, you know, book gifts for yourself.
Yes.
How
yes.
many books could you buy in a year challenge by Carly and
yes.
Susie?
Yes.
Every gift should be a book. You should put them on your list. We got to increase the literacy rate around here.
Well, to tie it to the first article we talked
yes.
about, right? Like, it's
yes.
it's a defiant stance at this point. So yes, please, everyone do that.
Yes. Okay. Another, you know, semi-viral article that I saw going around was on Substack. Substack is Renew with Amy Chan. It was written on July 11th, if you want to go back and grab it. Title, I spent $44,000 launching my book. Three of those dollars worked. And subhead, what actually sells books in 2026, what doesn't, and the expensive lessons I learned so you don't have to. So she kind of runs through, really like spells it all out. I spend $10,000 on a TikTok influencer campaign, $10,000 on a consultation speaking gig agency, $24,000 on a PR retainer, PR packages. Anyway, so she goes through pros and cons, what she actually thinks moved the needle. A lot of people think events, you know, for somebody in that space is probably the thing that moved the needle the most for her. So anyway, lots of gems. Cece, what did you think?
Something I really liked about this is that she highlights how podcasts work really well and worked really well for her. And yay for podcasts. So that was fun. I really enjoyed it. It's a really good article.
Yeah, no, it's a great one to dive into. So go check it out. Renew with Amy Chan. I spent $44,000 launching my book. Okay, the other article I saw going around is from June, so I don't know why it kind of came up on my feed a little bit later. Devin Halliday, Karen Gillespie said, why publishers prefer debut novels and what debut authors can do to ensure a book too. Cece, what were your notes on this one?
Okay, so the article is really well written and I really enjoyed it. I want to preface my notes with that. There are a couple things that I read that just knowing our listeners, we have so many listeners who read so closely and then they'll DM me to be like, hey, I noticed that this article had this one line that said X, but you guys have said Y. How do you reconcile that? And so I'll address that. The article says that a debut is the first novel that an author writes, and it's not. It's the first novel that an author sells. So many authors have written novels that never got picked up and, you know, before they found their agent. And the people writing the article know this. It's not like they're proposing something different. I want to flag that, just there's no misunderstanding. And then the other thing too is that there's a part in the article where it reads, there are plenty of reasons for a second or third or 15th novel to get picked up. Maybe one of the reasons that they're going over is maybe this new book is under option. And actually most contracts have option clauses, and that's no guarantee and certainly not a reason for another novel to get picked up. The option just means that the publisher is going to look at it before anyone else does, and they may offer, or they may not. I think what they meant to say is that one of the possibilities is that it's a part of a two or multi-book deal. So it's just, again, if you've read the article, it's these tiny things that can make a difference sometimes for our close readers who have lots of critical thinking, and we're so thankful for them. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I liked a lot of things about it. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, something stood out to me. So there was a question that the Substacker posed to who they were interviewing, which was somebody that works for Publishers Marketplace, who they catalog all the deals. And the question was, how much of the fiction marketplace is driven by debuts? And the person said, there's an average of 35 debuts sold monthly. They usually account for a third or more of all fiction deals. Overwhelmingly, debut deals go to young females under 40, basically the book talk audience. That's not my quote, that's theirs. I usually see only two or three male deals each month. Non-white authors are also not well represented. And then they go on to ask, why are publishers so eager to acquire debuts? And then they kind of talk about, you know, there's the thrill of discovery. This is Western culture loves the idea of talent springing into the world fully formed. It's a fairy tale more than a reality. Most accomplished debut novelists have several unpublished trunk novels, but the notion of a preternaturally gifted novelist is romantic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's one of those things where we know, we talked about this on the show so many times, about the concept of track and the good things about track, the bad things about track, but there's not really any getting around it. It's still the reality of our business.
It's just the model. I don't like that it's the model. I don't actually think that it's the best model for the medium. I just don't. And I don't just mean it from like a fairness perspective. It's unfair, but I'm putting that aside. I'm saying, I think it would be so much smarter if publishers did it in a different way, but I don't get to decide that. It is absolutely the model. You are worth more as a debut. I will never forget at one of our deep dives. I think it was the first deep dive, actually. I don't remember, but it was either the first or the second. So the author who wrote The Marsh King's Daughter, Karen Dion, did a wonderful presentation, like gave a wonderful presentation. And she talked about, you know, the fact that she was a mid-list author and then she wrote The Marsh King's Daughter, and that book blew up. She made a joke about how her agent hadn't believed that she wrote it because it was so different from everything else she wrote. And anyway, she She said this one thing that I know made a really big impression, which was the only thing that could have made the experience even better was if it had been my debut. Mm-hmm. Because there is something so special about debuting like that. And again, we don't like the model, but it is the model. Yeah. And I think it's important to know. It's important to know how the industry that you want to break into operates so that you can have realistic expectations and so you can know how to navigate it. There's a line in the article. People have been saying this a lot online too, but the line says, publishers usually blame lack of sales on the author, even though that's not particularly fair. People say this a lot. I've seen multiple threads by authors saying, my first book didn't sell, but the publisher is blaming me. And what they mean is the publisher isn't investing in my second book. I don't actually think they're blaming you. The concept of blame is quite personal. And I understand why people use that language, because writing is so personal. And so when someone says no to a second book, it feels like someone is blaming you. But I know for a fact the editors aren't blaming you, like, because the editors are people who believe in stories and
they're disappointed in the sales track too. They wish it sold more copies too.
Yes. And they don't think it's your fault, but it does mean that because of the model, they won't keep investing. So it's not a binary situation where it's, I will invest in you if I don't blame you. Like, that's just not how the mentality works. But people internalize the word blame and they repeat it. And I actually think that's a disservice to your entrepreneurial brain. Because if you think that you're being blamed, you take it way too personally. And then you can't like bounce back and strategize as a business person, which is what every writer needs to be.
Yeah, everybody takes it really personally. There was a paragraph kind of coming back to the idea of like how to continue your career. It said, the higher you advance, the closer an eye you'll need to keep on the quote tide, end quote, of optimism at your publishing house. Many decisions in the publishing industry are rooted in emotion rather than in financial calculation. A publisher that was excited to spend six figures on you can turn embarrassed and resentful if they begin to suspect that they made a huge mistake. This goes against what you just said. Like, do you think that's true? Yes and no?
That decisions are based in emotion?
That a publisher that was excited to spend six figures on you can turn embarrassed and resentful if they begin to suspect that they made a huge mistake.
I think they can feel embarrassed and resentful in their choice, but still not blame the author. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, they might go, oh, I made a wrong calculation when I thought this book was worth X, but I still don't think it's about blaming the author. And I'm not saying there aren't any situations where the author is blamed. Yeah. I just don't think that's the default. People use it as a default. I also think that part of the issue with this is, I don't have that quote in front of me, but it's something about like people look at emotions and not financial data.
Yeah.
Emotions are the data. Like how much a novel is worth, how much fiction is worth, is based on emotion. How a book made me feel is essential.
Yeah.
It's qualitative and it's essential. It is the hard data that will make me want to buy it. And there is no other hard data that we look at. When we buy a house, there is an emotional piece to it. I walked into a house and I'm like, I have to own this house. That's the emotional piece. But there's the hard data, the number of bedrooms, when the recent renovation happened, all these things. But in books, it's all the emotion. It's all the emotion and how you felt. Nobody's counting the number of verbs going, there are 18 erudite verbs. Therefore, this book is worth more. That's just not how it works. So it's an inescapable part of our industry that we trade in taste, and emotions are the data that tickle our taste buds. And like it or not, publishing is institutionalized gambling. I'm sorry to share that, but it is.
I think publishing's really good at leaning into the emotions when it's convenient and then leaning into the financial calculations when it's convenient, because it's not usually the other way around. Because when things are doing really well, the publisher should be like, hey, I can't wait to give this author the next big advance. And then you'll still have to fight tooth and nail with them about the big advance, right? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
It's absolutely.
It's always going to be when it's convenient to the publisher.
Absolutely. And, you know, when a book doesn't do as well as a publisher had hoped, they can point to the numbers, because then they do have actual hard data for that author. But before someone debuts, there's no hard data to look at. So it's just an inescapable part of debuting.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of great stuff in that article, so make sure you guys check it out. It's Devon Halliday, DevonHalliday. Check out that Substack and enjoy. That's all the material we have for today. So thanks for hanging out with us. We'll try to be more uplifting next week, but we can make no promises. We expect you, though, to be at our Substack Live. If you are a paid Substack subscriber to the podcast account, please come hang out with us on Wednesday. We're going to have lots of fun. And bring any of your kind of more complicated thoughts, because we have some time and space to get into them over there.
And bring your snacks. I always want to know what people are snacking on, because I'm always thinking about food. So bring your snacks, bring your questions, bring your tea. We're going to have a lot of fun together.
We will. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.